The next thing is the aesthetic impulse. I've already implied this, that as wonderful and as grand as art is, what we need to remember above all, especially since church music is basically the work of lay people. I've often, you know, let me say this. You know who the worship team is? It's the congregation. This worship team stuff, that's a term that was so carelessly invented. It was just plain careless. And it seems to me that it was, again, out of a theological misunderstanding that this team or those who lead in worship or almost bring it about. But that being aside, bear in mind that the property, the ownership of church music is the people of God. The congregation are the worship team. And I've been thinking of writing a little primer on church music and calling it the music of the people of God, and approaching church music not from the standpoint of high art, which most church musics do, not for entirely bad reasons, but the reasons are incomplete. You don't begin with high culture. You begin with what I've called in here the aesthetic impulse in point three. Art is not art because we can paint a picture of a tree. Music is not defined so because we try to imitate God singing over his people. We don't paint and sculpt and do those things because we're trying to do what we think God would do. These things exist because we have the urge to imagine and make out of things around us. Whatever the raw materials are, we have this urge to imagine with these raw materials and to make things out of these raw materials. What is music? Music is an insight that the human race has about the organization of pitches. There's an impulse in everybody about being attracted to pitches and how to imagine putting those pitches together. Music is nothing other than the organization of pitches in a temporal, that is a time frame, context. That impulse is in everybody. The aesthetic impulse is in everybody. In other words, capital B beauty, capital A art, or worse, capital A, capital R, capital T art. Those represent different stages in human thought about something very basic, namely that anybody loves to pick up a pencil and make a shape. Anybody likes to pick up a penknife and whittle. Little children take pitches and make tunes. Everybody loves to dance. Everybody loves to respond some way to something else by using their body. These are imago Dei things, but they're not there because we can prove that God dances, or that God writes fugues, or he can out Rembrandt. That's a theological, metaphysical issue for the imagination, but beneath that is this wonderful thing in the imago Dei that says, find what's around you, inquire into its meaning, into its potential, and imagine and make. So we have this thing called music. And interestingly enough, despite the philosophical institutions about aesthetics, despite theories of beauty, despite huge libraries full of books on what beauty is or is not, and despite our rather gradated definitions of beauty, where we end up by saying, well, it's in the eye of the beholder, or where others would say, no, it's not that easy. There is an objective standard called beauty to which everybody must adhere. No matter how this is articulated, the point is, there's nobody in this world that does not want to do things that they can somehow say, that's pretty. There's an impulse. It's almost like I wish the word beauty didn't exist, because it has been defined so many ways. But I'd rather, well, let me give you an example. There's an old guy that lives down the road from me in Idaho, Bud Pankratz, who incidentally, thanks be to Jesus, I led to Christ on his deathbed. After years of how to work at this, he came to Jesus on his deathbed. Bud was one of these guys who could make anything out of anything. He had, to me, a PhD in living. Totally another form of liberal arts education. He was a true maker of things. I walked into his shop one day. I said, Bud, I saw a wood stove. I said, Bud, that's a gorgeous stove. Where'd you buy that? He said, oh, I made that. I said, Bud, have you ever read books on Shaker architecture and art? I don't know who Shakers are. I said, Bud, there's something simple and plain and clean about this that is so attractive. He said, I just didn't want to get cold. let me just finish this. Go on with it. And I almost had tears, you know, and like I do now. He was such a great guy. But I said, I've got some books on Shaker architecture and art. I want to bring them over to you, because their wood stoves are almost exactly the way yours are. And they had a genius for simply beautiful things. And then I looked a little closer, and on the front door, where the handle of the front door was made out of, he bent one piece of iron with a welding torch, and then he put two Chevy valve springs together to make that part of the handle where you don't burn your hand, you know. And then I looked at the little thing you spin for a draft, you know, and I said, that's the prettiest thing. I said, it's so graceful. What is that? Oh, that's the tail end of an Oldsmobile drive shaft. I said, that's so pretty. He said, I didn't want to burn my hands. Now, what I'm driving at is that this guy had something in him, something there that says, I don't have any theories of beauty, but this is how I'm going to make this. He didn't even say, I'm going to make this, I want this to be pretty, because I know Bud better than that. He didn't want to burn his hands, but in putting it together, he made something beautiful. Now that is imago Dei in some wonderful way, that the institutions of the arts have capitalized on. But what we need to remember is that art is not there because there is art saying there will be art, and generations of artists saying there will be continuations of art. And it's not there because philosophers say there is beauty and here's how it can be described. As noble as all these are, and as much as I revere great works of art, almost to the point where I wish I didn't, because it's almost a burden to love beauty, at least the way I love it. It hurts. But in spite of all that, there are the Bud Pankratzes who said, I didn't want to burn my hands, but who made a winsome artifact. So the impulse to beauty, don't overlook among your people. They're not to be ripped off because their attention span is short. They're not to be ripped off because culture has been defined this way and that way by those who don't know what a theology of creativity is. The interesting thing about the layperson is that they will accept. Now, let me use two defining terms, mediocrity and musical mediocrity and musical goodness. The average layman will like both, probably. But the interesting thing is, they like beautiful stuff, but they don't always know the difference between it and something that's not quite as beautiful. But the thing that's become more important to me than ever is that they like beautiful things. So it's our task to school them to the extent to which they're able more and more to tell differences based on what they know but don't know. You follow that? Why is it that the average layman loves Amazing Grace? Not because it's become the cultural bagpipe tune for all funerals, world without end, amen. No, it's because it's a genius-ridden five-pitch tune. That is a very good tune. Why is it that a layperson loves the tune Hifradol? Da-dee-da-da-da-da-da. Why is that? You know, have you ever analyzed that tune? That tune is a six-pitch tune, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, but la is only used once in the tune. Da, da, dee, da, da, dee, da, da, at the very end. The sixth pitch is saved till the very end. The rest of the tune just ambivalates, peregrinates, wanders around with do, re, mi, fa, sol. Why do they like that? Because there's an impulse in the Imago Dei to like good things. The task, therefore, of the artistic educator, which is, whether you like it or not, one of your subtitles, is to praise people for what they do well without knowing why they do it, and to school them, to gentle them into more and more choices among good things. I was raised in the old standard of church music that the reason why you went into church music is so you could raise standards. You read the old books on church music, the Archibald Davison books. As noble as they were written from high culture down. They were not concerned with the what I would call the grassroots Imago Dei, what it means to be a grassrooted image of God. They didn't take their time enough with praising the laity for its inborn appreciation for beauty. And almost nothing was about being called by the Lord. You ever hear of the old bank robber Willie Sutton? Sort of American cult figure. Somebody asked Willie Sutton after he was caught all the years, why do you rob banks? He said, because that's where the money is. Well, you ask a lot of people, why are you in church music? Because that's where the organs are. Especially when they're more popular. I have a doctorate in organ performance, so I could have said that once. Why'd you take this job in Keokuk, Iowa? Because there's a 5-rank Aeolian Skinner there. Nothing about Jesus wants me to be there, you know. So the being raised on the cult of standards first as the sine qua non, at least in my life, turned out to be very dangerous. And as I said before, standards are now more important than they used to be because now they're the symptom of something more important, namely pouring perfume on Jesus' feet. Another thing about beauty, and I don't want you to think that I've gone postmodern or politically multicultural on you, because I'm neither. I loathe political multiculturalism. Not multiculturalism, but politicized multiculturalism. And I loathe the bad parts of postmodernism, even though there are some good parts. But at the risk of being labeled either one or the other, you've got to understand beauty is not an absolute. Beauty is a relativity. There is something right about the idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. There is something right about that. There's also something perverted about it. But there is something right about it. My concept of beauty is based on severely wonderful training in high culture. My concept of beauty is related in severely wonderful training in jazz. My concepts of beauty are based in severely wonderful training and thinking about bluegrass and folk, and country western. I keep going through repertoires, severe training in those. But if I am called to the Eastern Highlands of New Guinea, to the Usarufa tribe, I cannot talk about beauty in terms of, well, boy, you ought to listen to Elenia, a Cuban jazz pianist. All of a sudden, the name slipped. You can't listen to Tito Puente to get an idea. How lovely are thy dwellings? I can't do that. I asked Vida Chenoweth, who's one of the great Christian ethnomusicologists ever to be, and she also translated the Usarufa New Testament. I said to Vida one day, I said, Vida, I know that Western culture is known for its intellectual institutions, institutions of aesthetics, institutions of this kind of thought and that kind of thought. And I said, how do the Usarufans talk about quality? And she said, here's how they talk about quality. They say, our fathers would have never sung that song. That's how they handle it. They handle it in terms of history, oral tradition, but and also it's kind of polite to say it that way instead of saying your music stinks, or that's a shoddy tune, or like Elton Trueblood is supposed to have said, "Holy shoddy is still shoddy." That instead of that, they say, you know, our fathers would not have sung that, which lends a kind of reverential quality to saying that's not very good. So it's there all over the place, and I, you know, it just leads me to say that beauty is creationally normal. We need to assume that about people, and people are so, you know, culture is in a mess. It's in a horrible mess. But people are still imago Dei. Little children still cavort to a Bach jig. They still fall asleep to a Nigerian lullaby. They still draw the way Picasso drew. And they want to, they know why somehow the Egyptians put both eyes on the side of the same, on the same side of the head. That doesn't baffle them. It's sort of creationally normal. And what we need to do in our thinking as musicians is to understand the aesthetic impulse, that it's implicitly there. It's congenital. It's imago Dei. B, it's trainable. C, training is an act of love. These aren't in my notes. This comes to me this way now. But C, the urge toward beauty is transmitted as an act of love. It's a grace that we transmit. D, it's relative. It is not an absolute. The old romantic, I think it was Keats who said this, or Shelley, one of the romantic poets said, beauty is truth and truth is beauty. That is so wrong. That is so unbiblical. To say that beauty is truth and truth is beauty, because that what we're doing is coupling a relative thing to an absolute. And we can say, and I said this in Music Through the Eyes of Faith, while we can say that something is less beautiful than something else, we have no right to say that something is less true than something else. It's either true or it's false. But in the areas of aesthetics, it's degree and not kind. I think this is more beautiful. I think Mozart is more beautiful than the guy that was supposed to have poisoned him. I think that Bach is more beautiful than Buchstedt. I think that Brahms is more beautiful than Dvorak, so on and so forth. But, you know, then we're dealing with opinions. Well, no, I don't think so. Dvorak. But if you say, thou shalt not kill, you don't say, well, you know, I'm not sure. I need to pray for discernment about that, you know. So we yes, ma'am. No. Okay, let me try. A, beauty is inborn. I mean, it, and B, it's teachable. Yeah. The redemptive grace with which we train ourselves, train each other, train our congregations about quality. It's very, very important. But in honoring beauty, we cannot enthrone it. It's hard for me to say because I want to enthrone beauty. It is so beautiful. Beauty is so beautiful that you want to enshrine it somehow. I remember getting into an argument with two colleagues of mine, not at Wheaton, but from another institution. All of us had gone to Union Seminary together. And they heard a lecture I had given, I think at the National Association of Schools of Music. And they were just upset to death that I disengaged beauty and truth, saying that they were in two different orders altogether. And they said to us, beauty is truth. Well, I say, what do you do with the less than beautiful? Is it less than truthful? Well, not really. But and so then we, it's negotiable, but it's a goal. Now, keep going into musical process and world music.
Can I ask
yes, sir.
I'm struggling with the whole relationship between truth and beauty.
Yes.
Because I've said for years that the arts were truth and or beauty. Because not all truth was beautiful. And not everything that's beautiful is true. For instance, I'm into classic film. It's one of my hobbies.
Yeah.
And take a film like Schindler's List.
It's beautiful, but it's true, but it's not beautiful.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah.
But there's an artistic beauty to it and how it was done. But there's so many truths that the world is not beautiful.
I don't want to interrupt, but I have. But you're thinking absolutely right. I mean that's not really a struggle. As much as it is a paradox that something, well, let's turn it another way around. If I say Jesus saves, ain't that the damn truth? And I've heard people say that. That's not beautiful, but it's sure true. And the disjunction is there. Also, for somebody to do something beautifully, but it's loaded with falsehood. The worldview is false and everything. That doesn't destroy the idea that there's beauty there.
Right.
See, that simply undergirds the idea that beauty and truth are not an equation. They can be companions of each other. And in a certain respect, they can uphold each other. Although I want to be very careful when I say it that way. But they're not companions.
The Asher Lev books, are you familiar with those?
Yes.
That's what that's about.
Yes.
You know, a truth that isn't beautiful, but it has to be artistically told, and it's painful and it hurts.
That's right. And it's a wonderful struggle to be in. But at base, if you can hold to the idea that they are not equated, that beauty is not truth and truth is not beautiful, then you can say, and the Reformed Doctrine of Common Grace helps a lot on this. God allows ugly people to do beautiful things. Isn't it interesting that the people who gassed the Jews would go home and listen to Mozart and revel in its beauty? And they did. Why? Because there's no equation. None whatsoever. The thing that we have to be careful about in our craft of church music and our professions as Christians in the arts is to so spiritualize the arts that we can then, without even explicitly saying so, create the impression that beauty and holiness are somehow related, especially when we're told to worship in the beauty of holiness. But that is not an aesthetic word used in that context. God is not, because he's perfectly holy, is not aesthetically beautiful the way the world's greatest art would paint that, or where a perfected kind of art would show that. I'm going to get to this a little later, but maybe I can skip. No, I won't. Yeah, let me skip, because Psalm 19, and again, if you've read Music Through the Eyes of Faith, you might have picked this up. Psalm 19 does an incredible job of showing us the difference between God's handiwork and his truth. or between creation and revelation, or between truth and beauty. So does Job. So does Job. What is it? 30. When does God say, "Where were you when I did this, that, and the other thing?" In the 30s. Psalm 19 is so gorgeous because it talks about the heavens and the earth declaring the glory of God, the firmament showing His handiwork, and day unto day utters speech, night unto night knowledge. And then the Hebrew gets a little bit quirky there, and some translations say there is no place where their voice is not heard, and then other translations say, but there is no voice. Heavens declare the glory of God, so on and so forth, and then it says there is no voice. But here's the interesting thing. The rest of the psalm says, but, implicit, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimonies of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right. I forget the rest. And then it says a little further on, these are to be more preferred than gold or honey. What that psalm does is it does a gorgeous job of separating the beauty of creation from the truth of God's work. Only truth can convert. Beauty praises, it shows forth, it lauds, beauty points, but it can't expound. There's no way to go to a pine tree and have it say, Jesus saves. It can't say that. There's no way a galaxy can say, there is therefore now no condemnation. So the function that beauty has and the function that truth has are two entirely different realms. Now, what I can do is couple them without equating them, and I can state the truth beautifully, as George Herbert does in his poems, as the book of Job does in its exposition of the creation. I can state truth beautifully. I can also state it in a mediocre way, but it's still truth. I can do an ugly piece of artwork. I can be a Christian and still do ugly art. I mean, we prove that all the time. I think I said it in Unceasing Worship, but somebody said, God gave me this song. Well, my response is, well, God gave me breath, but that doesn't save me from having halitosis. That is to say, He gave me breath, but my breath can stink. So I have to go clean my teeth, or you better go fix that song up. It doesn't mean that because God gave it to you, it's beautiful. So these are things to think about. I'm not trying to propagandize. I'm not trying to brainwash. I just want you to think about these things.